All right, good morning. We are going to be in 2 Samuel 19. So we're in it. We're going to be covering a chapter today that is largely politics. We've come off the war, all the excitement of all that in the last couple chapters, and now is kind of putting the pieces back together. I mean, literally, we've had a civil war in Israel between a father and a son, between David and Absalom, and now chapter 19 is basically the reconstruction process about what's going on. So where we left off, if you remember, is Absalom, unfortunately, was hung up in that tree, and Joab took the opportunity to kill him until he was dead with all those spears, right? I think we counted 13 spears in total, and that's kind of hard to survive 13 spears through the heart, and that's what happened. And when we got back, we figured out David got the word from the messengers that Absalom was dead, and he was in mourning, and that's kind of where we pick up at the beginning of chapter 19. Is David's grief coming out very clearly as the war has ended. So, first four verses of chapter 19. Says, "Then it was told Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. The victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people, for the people heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son. So the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. The king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son," which is the same refrain we heard from him at the end of chapter 18. So essentially what you're seeing here is David is ruining the day. Okay? They've just won a battle. They are victorious. And normally when you win a battle, okay, I'm picturing like those parades they did after World War II, you know, with all that and all the confetti pouring down and all like that. That's kind of the picture. We're celebrating. War is over. We're victorious. But that's not at all what happens in Israel, because when they walk in the city, I mean, I just, you know, it's kind of a caricature, but David's doing the loud, ugly cry, and it's just awkward for everybody, you know, like nobody really knows what to say. So they're just kind of sneaking back into the city, heads down, because the king, who is now, well, they're not in Jerusalem yet, but the king back in Mahanaim, where the king is supposed to be celebrating. His kingdom is saved. He's supposed to be back on the throne, and he's wailing and grieving quite loudly, quite publicly. And so there is no celebration for David's forces. It says the victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people. So instead of music and dancing, so the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. So it's exactly the opposite attitude that you would expect for a victorious army. And again, a public grief for David. He covered his face and cried out with a loud voice. All right, so it's pretty awkward. Verse 5. Then, here's Joab. Joab came into the house to the king. And remember, Joab is addressing the king of Israel here. And notice that Joab is not really using any kind of decorum in his address of David. Today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now, therefore, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. So the king arose and sat in the gate. And when they told all the people, saying, behold, the king is sitting in the gate, then all the people came before the king. Now Israel had fled each to his tent. All right. So here's Joab. There's no crying in war. What are you doing? You've won. This is not the attitude you're supposed to have in victory. This is not the attitude you're supposed to have as a king. Okay? So, and David's actions so incensed Joab. I mean, I didn't read that with due justice. I mean, I think Joab is yelling at David, which again, this is an army leader, a general coming in and speaking to the king. There is no "Your Majesty." He's in his face, and he's criticizing. What are you doing? You're about to lose everything you just got back. And he rebukes him quite loudly. And so laying aside all formalities, Joab informs David on the strongest of terms that through his unseemly behavior, he had humiliated all the men who had just saved his life and the lives of his family. And so Joab has to kind of say, hey, wake up. You realize that we just had a civil war. You realize that half of the country, maybe more, just went with your son, just sided against you. And so these men who have stayed with you, who have been loyal, who were outnumbered, who risked their lives for your kingdom, and now you mourn for the guy that raised the rebellion against you, and you have said nothing to your troops that all risked their lives for you. Hey, you've already, you know, there's part of the group you don't even know are loyal yet, and the ones that are loyal with you, you've now insulted. You've now just said your sacrifice has been taken for granted, and he says you need to fix this right away. Hey, because if that group goes away from you, you will not be king much longer. Hey, Joab understands the situation here. Hey, and he says, by yearning after a dead enemy, David is making it clear that if Absalom were alive, if all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. You would rather your whole army died and your rebellious son, who was trying to kill you and take your throne, were alive. And Joab's trying, do you see the problem here, David? And his actions convey to the troops that had risked their lives on his behalf contempt and ingratitude, and David desperately needs their support to continue. Okay, so Joab is tough here. It's tough love, but he's right. And in the same way that we talked last week in killing Absalom, now we can talk about the methodology, but Joab's probably right. Absalom deserves death. Now we can talk about he executed that unlawfully, sure. But he knows that if he lets Absalom live, that David would restore Absalom. And we see that right here. I mean, that's David's reaction. And so he's tough, but he's right. And so not only is David's behavior wrong, it's foolish, it's short-sighted. Because he has to realize that he needs the support of the people. So the king had deeply offended his troops, and if he did not act immediately to make amends, Joab says, surely not a man will pass the night with you. The whole city will empty out if you don't get out there and fix it right now. You won't have an army tomorrow. And you think it was tough when you were outnumbered, you know, 10-1? Just imagine when you don't have an army. You know, you will not be long for the throne if you don't get out there and fix it. Okay? So he tells him to apologize. Okay? I had to throw a wrestling picture up there. All right. And if he doesn't, Joab says, this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. Well, that's, David's dealt with a lot of evil, hasn't he? He's dealt with Saul. He's dealt with the fallout of his sin. He's dealt with so much stuff, right? And Joab says, this will be the worst because you will not keep your throne if this happens. And so his methods aren't pleasant. But it can be argued that his actions toward both Absalom and David saved David's kingship. If Joab doesn't go in there and get in David's face, David may not hold the throne. I mean, it's that's how vital this conversation is. So we're talking about this reconstruction effort. And David listens to Joab. He listens. He figures it out. So the king arose and sat in the gate, and all the people came before the king. So why does he go to the gate? Because that's where the king's supposed to be. Remember Absalom? What did Absalom do to gain the hearts of the people of Israel? He sat in the gates, and when people came with petitions, he said, yeah, it'd be nice if the king was here to listen to you, but he doesn't really care about you. I wish I were the king so I could fulfill your need. Remember, he used the gate because that's what the king was supposed to do. The king sat in the gate. The king made judgments, and that's always been the case. Again, think back to the book of Ruth. Where does Boaz go to do his legal proceedings? He goes to the gate. Right? That's where the men of the city sat. That's where judgments took place. That's where law took place. That's where the king sat. So we have returned to normalcy. Right? And before you say that's not a word, Warren G. Harding said it was a word in his campaign. Going some U.S. history for you as well. He made up that word, so I'm going to quote normalcy. All right? Normality is actually the correct grammatical term, but we're going to go with normalcy. All right? So the king is in the gate where he's supposed to be. Hasn't been there in a while. It's a good thing he's back where he's supposed to be. So this is a necessary confrontation. Joab's execution of Absalom cost him his position, at least temporarily. That Joab's going to get fired for this. Because he killed Absalom, and maybe rightly so, because it was a direct violation of David's order, right? David made a public order, don't touch Absalom if you can help it. And Joab goes total insubordination, rebels against that, and kills Absalom. So it's going to cost him his job, at least for a little while. Okay? And then nevertheless, his rebuke of the king was good as well as needed. and a true friend. And Joab was a true friend to David here. I'm not saying that Joab was always a true friend to David, but in this case, he's a true friend to David. He's telling David what he needs to hear. And a true friend is willing to take personal risks to confront a friend in love. There's a lesson for us in that. A true friend doesn't not talk about issues. A friend talks about issues, right? That's such a Christian idea in terms of our brothers and sisters, is we are there to call to account our brothers and sisters. That's our job. Why do we do weddings in front of the church? So that the church can hold the couple accountable for the vows that they've taken before God, right? That's why we do a baptism in front of the church, because the church holds the person accountable who is professing Christ in baptism, right? And so that's what Joab's doing. He's holding his friend accountable. And a wise person such as David will accept strong advice from a friend who really cares. That's Christian maturity in our sense, because our flesh says, I know better than you know, and I shouldn't have to listen to you. But in humility, we should listen to friends who are willing to bring that to our attention. And David does that, and it's going to save his kingdom. All right, verse 9. All the people were quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel. So it's not happy times in Israel, even after all that. Saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back? All right, so what's going on here? Well, all the people of Israel who sided with Absalom are now in a bit of a fix, right? What are we going to do? Because David was a pretty good king. We like David. He saved us many times. But we sided with Absalom. Well, we sided with the wrong guy because that guy's dead now. What are we going to do? Do we bring David back? Because David's not back in the promised land yet. David is still over across the Jordan. Do we bring him back? Do we put him back on the throne? Okay, so after the rebellion, Absalom's troops returned to their clans. This is every man in Israel went back to their own tent. Okay? There's nobody outside of the city trying to figure out what's going on. They went back home and are just praying for the best at this point. And once they heard that Absalom was dead. And so debates begin to rage about Israel's future, especially about whether to realign themselves with David. And again, they're reminded that previously David had fulfilled marvelously the nation's expectations for a king, defeated the Philistines, saved their land. And with Absalom dead, they had no realistic alternative but to bring the king back. Right? Obviously, he's supposed to be the king. Let's get back behind him again. These are the northern tribes, by the way. This is Israel. These are the northern group. Okay, and the kingdom is not yet divided that we're going to see later on, right? After Rehoboam, Jeroboam, when we get the split. That hasn't happened yet, but there is a clear divide between Israel and Judah. There is a clear divide between the 10 northern tribes and maybe sometimes 11. Benjamin's kind of like the swing state in the elections. Like sometimes Benjamin's red, sometimes Benjamin's blue. We never know where they're going to swing to. When the split happens, they stay south. But sometimes they go back and forth. So really, what we see in the Old Testament is a clear distinction from Judges on between Judah and the northern tribes. Read Judges chapter 1 and 2, and you'll see how positive Judah is the only tribe that comes close to doing what they're supposed to be doing and getting rid of the Canaanites in the land. The rest of Judges 1 and 2 is a record of how all the other tribes did not do what they were supposed to do. And the author is trying to show us, look, Judah at least did the right thing most of the time, right? Why does Judah last, 150 years longer than Israel does? Because at least they had a few good kings, at least they had a few things going for them. Israel was always negative. There's always kind of an anti-Ephraim, anti-northern bias in the scriptures because they were so kind of jacked up. So if you read Judges, Samuel, and Kings, you'll pick up on that. The north is kind of bad, the south is better. Not great, but they're better, and that's what we'll see. Same thing here. And David has some work to do because Judah had largely sided with Absalom. Where did Absalom declare himself king? In Hebron, in the heart of Judah. Okay, so David's own people have gone with his son. Benjamin, that's Saul's kinsman. Right? They had rooted for David to fail because they want revenge for Saul not being on the throne anymore. And then the northern tribes basically feel like second-class citizens because we're not even in the political process. We've been left out, right? No taxation without representation, right? They don't think they're being considered. And so David has the whole country to get back in line, okay? He needs to make Israel great again. That's his challenge, okay? He wants to bring everybody back together in one, and that's going to be difficult, okay? So verse 11. Then King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You are my brothers, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king?" Okay, so number one, go to Judah. Sends the two priests down to Judah. Ask them why they haven't given support back to me again. Verse 13, say to Amasa. Remember, Amasa is the nephew of David who was leading Absalom's troops, cousin of Joab. Say to Amasa, "Are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab." Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, saying, "Return, you and all your servants." The king returned and came as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to go to meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan. Okay? So this is David getting support back. Israel is back on board. We just read that. Israel said, "Hey, we don't have anything else to do." That was Israel's rationale, right? "Well, we were with Absalom. Absalom's dead. David's been a pretty good king to us. We should bring him back." And then Judah hasn't said anything yet. So David sends word down and says, "Where are you, Judah? You know, you're my brothers. You're the ones that are supposed to be with me. Why are you the last ones to get word to me?" Judah says, "You're right," and Judah jumps on board. And then the last thing that he does is that he goes to Amasa, and we'll talk about that in a second. That's quite a political move. But again, he has to get Judah back. If he doesn't have Judah back, he's got nothing. Those are his people. If his own people don't support him, you know, it's kind of like, go back to think modern elections and stuff, and it's like when a candidate runs from a certain state and that state doesn't even vote for him. And you're like, they're probably not a good national leader if your own state doesn't even elect you. You know, that's kind of, so he needs Judah. He needs them to get back. And apparently David had alienated Judah many times. The Calebites, especially the Ziphites, that's 1 Samuel 23. And then we get the episode with Nabal. If you remember Nabal's, his wife was Abigail. Nabal should be, remember David goes and requests food and help, and Nabal basically curses him and says, "I'm not giving you anything." Nabal dies about a week later, and David actually takes Abigail and marries her. But that's in the heart of Judah. That's a man in Judah that is not cooperating with David. So there are parts of Judah, even though that's David's group, that's his core group, that don't agree with him. And so he's got to get those people back on his side. Okay. So again, first step is to send Zadok and Abiathar. Okay. Go. If I send my two chief religious leaders, that will carry a lot of weight. If the two priests in Israel can support David, everybody should. And that's, I think, what brings Judah back, is if Zadok and Abiathar are there, that brings the sense of solidarity there with the brothers. All right, and two, and this is the political part, is he's going to bring in Amasa. Now, what's the parallel here? It would be like at the end of the Civil War if Lincoln went to Robert E. Lee and said, "I want you to lead the Union Army." That's essentially what is happening here. Right now, what would be the reaction to many in the North to that? Okay, they wouldn't be happy about that. But what would it do? What would be the rationale? Well, I mean, and this, you know, if you study U.S. history, this is an interesting kind of what if kind of thing. If Lincoln had not been assassinated, Lincoln's plan was to be much more, you know, nice, genteel to bringing the southern states back in. When he's assassinated, the radical Republicans say, how am I talking about up here? Right? When he's assassinated, the radical Republicans take over, and that's what brings in Reconstruction. That's what brings in most of the animosity that builds between the North and the South, and then all the fallout from all that. Well, if Lincoln had been there, could he have facilitated that sort of thing? David's trying to facilitate that. If I bring their guy in as a main part of my leadership, then that will make the Israelites go, oh, look, maybe we're not second-class citizens. He's using one of our guys. He's using the guy that led our army, or at least Absalom's people, to bring back in. So, and it does two things. Number one, it builds a bridge with people that were fighting for Amasa, and we know anything that troops are loyal to their general. And so he thinks if he can bring that general in, it'll strengthen the army. And number two, it punishes Joab. Okay? It fires Joab from his position for his insubordination. So he's accomplishing two things. Because if he leaves Joab in the position, then Joab has once again gotten away with murder, quite literally, in that sense, and David doesn't want to let that happen. So this solves two problems, and we'll see the fallout of that in the next chapter. Okay? And it's very successful. All the hearts of the men of Judah turn to David. And they send word to the king saying, "Return, you and all your servants." So David and his entourage begin the return journey to Jerusalem, led back into the promised land by the tribe of Judah, which is exactly what David needs. He needs his people leading him back in. Notice that they meet there at Gilgal. What's the significance of Gilgal back earlier in the Old Testament? Okay, that's where Joshua camped when they came over, So quite symbolic that David would bring his people across the Jordan to Gilgal. Remember, that's the faith act when Joshua brings the men across the Jordan and they camp at Gilgal, and then he has them do the circumcision and all that on this side of the Jordan, right? Which instead of the other side where they had security, he says, come over here, we're in view of Jericho, we're going to do all that here, and the men can't fight for several days because of that. And it's faith that God is going to protect them in the face of the into the promised land. So Gilgal is the place. All right, verse 16. Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was from Bahurim. Remember, he was the guy that was cursing and throwing dust at David as they crossed over the Mount of Olives. Lost my place. There we go. Hurried, and he came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, with Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul. Remember Ziba, the guy that lived and helped Mephibosheth. And his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. And they rushed to the Jordan before the king. And then they kept crossing the ford to bring over the king's household and to do what was good in his sight. And Shimei the son of Gera fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king. So once David wins, Shimei knows, all right, I'm in trouble now. Because I just cursed the king up and down as he left the city, and now he's coming back. So he runs down to meet him. Hey, no one had been more vocal in his disdain for David. Remember, he says he calls him a man of bloodshed. He says, you're a worthless fellow. Total insults as he walks away. And remember, David's men want to go kill him. Abishai specifically wants to go, let me go over there and kill him. And David says, no, we're not doing that today. Maybe the Lord is giving him a message to me. But he's the first one to get back to David and ask for forgiveness. And he's accompanied by 1,000 Benjamites and Ziba. Ziba, who also, these are the two descendants of Saul that David met on the Mount of Olives, Ziba and Shimei. And he brings all his servants and stuff down to the Jordan. And Shimei, he's probably soaking wet, because if you notice there, it says he meets him on the other side of the Jordan. So Shimei comes sprinting down, dives into the Jordan, swims across. He's soaking wet. He's out of breath, and he falls on his face in front of David before he can even come back into the promised land and begs forgiveness at that point. Okay, he says, let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong. And he says, your servant knows that I have sinned. He confesses his sin to David. What I said was wrong. I sinned against you. Please forgive me. Right? Because he knows with, you know, a word, David can execute him because he's blasphemed against the king. All right, and here's David's men once again, verse 21. But Abishai, that's Joab's brother, one of the generals, the son of Zeruiah, said, should not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? And David then said, what have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I not know that I am king over Israel today? The king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And thus the king swore to him. Now, that won't be lasting for all life, because Solomon will kill Shimei on David's advice. But he says, you shall not die. At least you shall not die today. Okay? So Abishai hasn't forgotten, right? I remember this guy. I was there when he cursed you the first time, and I wanted to kill him then, and he didn't let me. Remember back in 16:9, he said, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. Let me bring his head back to you. And David says, no. And now again, he cursed the Lord's anointed. Let me go over there. You see, Abishai is not much different than Joab. You know, he wants action. He wants something to get done. Let me go kill him. David says that's not going to happen. Okay? And he refuses to execute him. What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? That's Joab and Abishai. Okay. What have I to do with you two brothers, right? I'm not happy with you two guys, is what he's saying there, that you should this day be an adversary to me. That it's interesting there, the term adversary. Does anybody know what the Hebrew there for adversary is? It's Satan. Okay? It's where we get our word Satan. Okay, so this is very much like Jesus saying to Peter, get behind me, Satan. It's David saying to Abishai, what have I to do with you? Why are you being a Satan to me? Get behind me. Okay, stop being an adversary to me. I'm a king. And Joab's done the same thing. When he killed Absalom, he was an adversary to David because he was rebelling against the order of the king. So David decrees an oath that Shimei would not die for his crime, and I think that's more for these two brothers than anybody else. I think he probably stared them down when he made this oath. Right? He will not die. Did you guys hear that? Because you obviously didn't hear it when I said it about Absalom. Okay, just want to make sure you heard it. He's not going to die. Okay? And we're not going to kill a man as I come back in and take the throne. All right, verse 24. Then Mephibosheth. So we're meeting all the guys that we heard about in previous chapters. Then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Now remember, the word from Mephibosheth came from Ziba that Mephibosheth had rebelled and sided with Absalom, hoping that the Saulite dynasty would come back into power. That was the story. So here comes Mephibosheth. And he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. So he's a mess, and he's an absolute mourning. It was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? Why didn't you cross with me?" So he answered, "O my lord the king, my servant deceived me." That's Ziba. "For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king because your servant is lame." So Ziba just left Mephibosheth at the house. "Moreover, he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your sight. For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king?" So the king said to him, "Why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided, you and Ziba shall divide the land." And Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house." All right, so interesting idea here. Like the others, Mephibosheth travels down from Jerusalem to the Jordan to meet David. Remember we talked about that? That's thousands of feet in elevation. That's 20 miles or so of hard travel. Must have been brutal on a guy like Mephibosheth. Remember, he's lame in both feet. This is not an easy journey, and yet he makes the journey all the way. He could wait at Jerusalem for him. He meets David at the Jordan, and he's in mourning. He looks terrible. Says he neither cared for his feet, trimmed his mustache, washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. So we don't know how long this campaign has lasted, but it's been a little while. Okay? So he hasn't cared for himself in, you know, a month, 2 months, whatever it's been. He probably looks pretty rough. And I say that to say you wouldn't be able to throw together a look of mourning in one day. You know, it's not like, oh, I got to go down and meet David. Let me look as terrible as I possibly can, and then maybe he'll forgive me. He's obviously been in mourning. He looks so awful you couldn't fake it. You know, he hasn't done anything. And this doesn't fit Ziba's description. Remember, Ziba said he's staying in Jerusalem. "Today the king of Israel, the house of Israel, will restore the kingdom of my father to me." And so David's kind of mystified. He's like, "What are you doing here? I figured you'd be on the run by now because you'd betrayed me. Why didn't you come with me?" But then he looks at him and goes, "Yeah, but you look like you've been mourning." So David's trying to figure out what's going on here. Okay? And notice the refrain over and over again from Mephibosheth. "My lord the king, my lord the king, my lord the king, my lord the king." Over and over again, that's what he calls David. Okay? That's a loyalty. That's what David's men have called him. Remember when we talked about Hushai in the king's court with Absalom? He kept saying, "Long live the king, long live the king," and he was talking about David. But that wasn't a direct address. Now we've got a direct address of "my lord the king." That's showing that Mephibosheth is with him. Okay, well, my clicker stopped working. There we go. So Mephibosheth submits his fate to the hand of King David. He says, "You know, I didn't do anything wrong. I've been in mourning. I'm not in rebellion, but you're the king. You do what's right." He trusts David, lays his life in David's hands. He says David's given him far more. You know, when I came along, I was in exile. My house was full of dead men, right? And you've given me, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. My life is in your hands. So now David has to figure out what he's going to do. Because remember, he gave Ziba all of Mephibosheth's land back in chapter 16 because he thought Mephibosheth was a traitor. Okay, so Ziba had provided him with invaluable assistance during a time of great need, had given him supplies, had given him convincing testimony that Mephibosheth was a traitor. But on the other hand, Mephibosheth has given us evidence here that he's not a traitor, that he has been in mourning since David left, and it's credible testimony. All right, so David had given Saul's estate to Ziba for two reasons: one, to reward his support, and two, to punish the betrayal of Mephibosheth. But now that Mephibosheth has been exonerated, I don't need to stop saying that name. It's really difficult. David decrees a compromise, right? This is David's Solomon moment, by the way. It's not quite as dramatic as Solomon's judgment. Remember the two women with the child, right? And what does Solomon say? Well, we'll just divide the child in two. And the woman that really loves the child, that is the mother, says, "No, just give the child to her. I'd rather the child live than that." Well, he does it with land here. David says, "Well, I'll divide the land in half." And what does Mephibosheth say? "Give him all land. I don't care. I just want you back on the throne. I'm here to serve you." Right? And so what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that Mephibosheth is the loyal one here. He's the one that's not scheming. He's the one that's not lying in this case, and it shows his humility. Okay, and so Ziba's going to retain a reward for his service to David, and David would keep his word to Jonathan from years before to provide for his son. And again, this is David's divide the child moment in wisdom. Again, we get a much more dramatic example when Solomon does it. All right, 31. How are we doing on time? All right. Now, Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Rogelim, and he went on to the Jordan with the king to escort him over to the Jordan. Now, Barzillai was very old, being 80 years old, and he had sustained the king while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. And the king said to Barzillai, "You cross over with me, and I will sustain you in Jerusalem with me." So here's an example of one of David's benefactors, one of the men that provided for David as they were across the Jordan. And David says, "You know what? I want to reward you. I want to bring you into the royal court. Come back to Jerusalem with me and live with me in the palace." Okay? He had supplied David and his entourage with all that food when they got to Mahanaim. He had traveled 50 miles down to Jordan. 80-year-old man travels 50 miles down to see the king over the Jordan. And David shows his appreciation by inviting him to return with him to Jerusalem. All right? Now here's what Barzillai says in response to that. Barzillai said to the king, "How long have I yet to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm too old to go to Jerusalem. I am now 80 years old. Can I distinguish between good and bad? Or can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Or can I hear any more the voice of singing men and women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord and the king?" Like, I'm not there. I understand what you're doing for me. You want to be nice, but I'm not going to serve your court. I'm not going to be able to do anything for you. "Your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king compensate me with this reward? Please let your servant return that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. However, here is your servant Chimam. Let him cross over with my lord and king, and do for him what is good in your sight." And the king answered, "Chimam shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what is good in your sight, and whatever you require of me, I will do for you." And all the people crossed over the Jordan, and the king crossed too. And the king then kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his place. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimam went on with him, and all the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel accompanied the king. All right, so Barzillai says, "Thanks, but no thanks. Let me go back and die in my own city. That's fine, but I've got a servant here. I've got a friend. He's younger. Take him. That'll be a blessing to me that you take him, and he will be with you in Jerusalem." And David says, "Exactly right, and we'll take him instead." And so Chimam fills Barzillai's place of honor. And here's an interesting thing in Jeremiah 41. In this description, it says, "And they went and stayed in Gareth Chimam, which is beside Bethlehem, in order to proceed into Egypt." Well, Jeremiah is a couple hundred years after David, right? Well, there is a place. Gareth Chimam means the lodging place of Chimam, right outside Bethlehem, which is just south of Jerusalem. So what does this confirm for us in Jeremiah? That David established a place for Chimam in honor of Barzillai and his service over there. So David keeps his word, because 200 years later, there's still a place named after this Chimam who had come over with David when he came back to keep his throne. So David has kept his word. He has promised Barzillai, and he does it exactly right. So this is that same Chimam, okay? So we're wrapping up here. The power of forgiveness. David had not really forgiven Absalom. Remember, he had come to the city, but he wouldn't speak to him. And perhaps the consequences of his lack of forgiveness encouraged him to take a different approach with his subjects after Absalom's death. Maybe David has learned a lesson here. We see in David's dealings with Amasa that forgiveness wins over former enemies. We see in his dealings with Shimei that forgiveness gives time for people to change. We see in his treatment of Mephibosheth and Ziba that forgiveness placates irreconcilable adversaries. And then we see in his relations with Barzillai and Chimam that forgiveness causes blessings to overflow to others. So it's David's ability to forgive that creates an environment where he's going to be able to go back to his throne. Right? He forgives the men that rebelled against him with Absalom. He forgives Israel for any kind of disrespect that they've shown him. He forgives specific men that cursed him. And he forgives all these men to create a situation where we can maybe get unity again. And this is the closest thing to unity we'll have in Israel until it all falls apart here in another 50 years or so. It's not long for the world. All right, so let's finish up with 41 to 43.
And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over the Jordan? So just when you think everything's great. How come we didn't get to go first? How come Judah gets to go first, right? We were the first ones that told you we wanted you back. Why aren't we going first? Then all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative to us. He likes us better. Why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten it all at the king's expense, or has anything been taken for us? But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king, therefore we also have more claim on David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. So it's just this big argument as David comes back in on who gets to walk in first, right? Anybody have little children? You ever hear this argument? Okay, it happens all the time. So even before David can return to Jerusalem, the men of Israel demand an explanation on why he permitted Judah to steal him away. And apparently by having all the Judahite soldiers, but only half the Israelite soldiers, participate in transporting the royal household across the Jordan, David had shown contempt to those who made a united monarchy possible, right? It's like 2018, where everybody's offended by everything that you do, right? If you say one thing, it's this whole idea of tolerance, right? That tolerance is a myth, because if I'm tolerant of one thing, then I'm immediately intolerant of another thing, right? Well, because you took more Judahites, then you are now you're bigoted against us. What I brought half of your troops too, you know, and in number, there's probably more of them, but anyway, and the men of Judah are coming back at him. Hey, he's our family. He's our next of kin. We haven't abused it. We haven't eaten his food, but he's closer to kin to us, so we should be able to bring him in. And so Judah claims kinship. Israel claims numbers, and since they were larger, we have more claim. We have 10 parts. You have one part. Okay, we deserve more. And so you see this just going back and forth and back and forth, and this is what I picture, right? It's like little kids fighting over a toy on the playground, right? We should take him in first. No, we should take him in first. No, but we're bigger. Yeah, but we're smarter. Yeah, but we're prettier. Like, I mean, it's just this back and forth argument about silliness, but what it shows you is that Israel is not at all stable, even under a united monarchy with David and Solomon. The instability is there. The cracks in the wall are there. So when we see it split down the road in Kings, it shouldn't be a huge surprise. Because they've been fighting since Judges. You know, they haven't been getting along for a while. And they've had a history of grumbling even before that, right? Just ask Moses. He knew all about that. So the good news is David's back on the throne and ruling over all Israel from Dan to Beersheba. He's got a united Israel. But the bad news is disunity is alive and well in Israel. It's not exactly stable. And so, from a prophetic perspective, Nathan's, remember, had this sword of judgment. Therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house. Well, it's not only not departed from his house, but it hasn't departed from his nation. And it's going to be strife in the nation for a while. And just when we think everything's kind of getting back to normal, when we get to next week in chapter 20, we got another rebellion. And it won't take long. It's like they're going to get to Gilgal, and they're hanging out, and all of a sudden some guy just starts another rebellion. All right, so the end of this tries to kind of show you the fallout of David's sin has created less than a strong foundation for Israel. And so it has permeated everywhere. And even though they brought him back, and even though the Lord is preserving him because of his covenant, it's not positive and it's not stable, and there's rebellion and disunity all over the place. All right. Anyway, all right. Any questions, comments, before we get to the next rebellion next week? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. There's so many good parallels there. I think the disciples' parallel is a good one. You know, I mean, at the Last Supper, they're going, I'm going to be better than you. I'm going to be first. Who's going to be greatest in the kingdom? Like,
have you guys not listened for the last 3 years? You know, like, Jesus has been telling you this and you won't listen. So I think that's good. And then, I mean, you can take this all the way to right now in America, right? Why do we have all this disunity politically and all that? It's because I'm more important than he is. And my group's more important than they are. And it's all pride. It's all, I want to be first. I think. And the fact that he's lame and broken, it's a good picture. Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you think about David taking the city and them mocking him with the lame and the broken, and then here's Mephibosheth coming in with him. Yeah, that's good. Yep. Yeah, I think he's probably in the last 10 years or so of his reign at this point. Sure. Yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely see it. Because I think, you know, David kind of hits his peak of hubris and pride with Bathsheba, which is, you know, 20-something years in. So it's probably been 8 or 10 years since then. So yeah, there's been some lessons learned, I'd imagine, through all this. And it's a softened David at this point. Is there a hand over here somewhere? Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's like we get a retro David here. It's like he finds himself again for a minute, you know, at this point. Because, I mean, really, if he wants to, he has all the power in the world. I mean, he can come in and execute everybody. I mean, what would normal kings do in this region of the world? Well, you're killing everybody that even thought about rebelling against you. And here's David bringing an entirely different paradigm into play. Truth and justice, you know, and forgiveness. And that's unheard of. And it speaks a lot about David at that point. All right, anything else before we close up? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think some of it's just practicality. I think some of it's that. And Solomon's a young king, and so I think there's some dad protecting his son a little bit. I think he's also... David keeps his word in a sense because he says, basically, I won't kill him, but I never said Solomon won't. You know, and I think he knows Joab. We've seen Joab, and he doesn't want, I think a lot of it's just practical stuff. You know, I think it's a king, you know, last words of a father to a son, here's what you need to do to have a successful kingdom. Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. All right, let me close with a word of prayer then.